Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Booth 61. Featuring movers and shakers on the Atlanta tech scene, organizations serving the tech market, and the inspired people who lead them. Now here's your host, Ricky Steele.
Welcome and thank you for visiting Booth 61. I am Ricky Steele and I passionately serve as the Chief Development Officer for Hunter Technical Resources, Atlanta's premier IT staffing firm. We have an extremely exciting show for you today, and we're going to jump right in. But first, I must introduce our producer and my friend, Kevin Finn. Kevin is a master at the control board, but he's also a very accomplished host and does a lot of great shows here at Business Radio X. We had a great time last night at a Business Radio X social at the Concourse, didn't we, Kevin?
It was awesome. Good drinks, good food, good company.
No question about it. And please jump in at any point if you have a question for John.
I will indeed.
Go from there.
I'm excited about this interview.
I cannot probably express how excited I am about today's show. As all of you know that have been listening, our goal for Booth 61 is to build community and allow the rising tide to lift all the boats. With me today is a man who, for anyone in the technology industry in Georgia for the last 30 years, needs no introduction whatsoever. John C. Yates is the managing partner of the technology practice at Morris, Manning & Martin. In introducing John, I feel much like a mosquito in a nudist colony. I don't know where to begin. There's enough meat to go for hours and hours and hours. John's accomplishments truly are the foundation of our technology industry in Georgia today. I will say John is a Duke graduate. He has a wonderful and a giving wife who I've had the privilege of spending some time with, Ellen, and his son Paul is working at a technology company here in Atlanta and is a graduate of Furman, where I think John also sits on the board of trustees at Furman. John has been a friend of mine, a mentor, a confidant, a breakfast mate. He's a brother in our faith walk together, and he's been an inspiration for me for almost 20 years. In addition, in his casual and kind manner that he has, John referred me to the biggest single sale of my entire career when I was with PricewaterhouseCoopers in the early 90s. Now, many people would have tried to collect on the debt that I owed many, many times probably over the years, but not John Yates. Please Google John Yates the next time you have a day or two in a spare time and you want to read some very interesting and impressive information, and you will do that. Mr. John Yates, welcome to Booth 61.
Ricky, thank you. It's an honor to be here with you, and thanks for that very kind introduction. You have actually set the gold standard for me, particularly the gold standard for friendship in this community, and I value it, and I know so many other people do as well.
Thank you very, very much. Well, where in the world do we begin, and when can you come back for the next show? Because I'd like to do a mini-series here. How and why did you begin in Atlanta, John? Because I know after you graduated from Duke, your sister was in the technology community in California, and there was a rumbling that you might go out and join her. How did Atlanta win the contest?
Well, I think it was very fortuitous, Ricky, but it actually turned out that my sister and I both went to Duke University, and my sister Jean graduated 3 years before I did, and she decided to seek her fortune in Silicon Valley. So much to the chagrin of her parents, she traveled to California and got involved with something called the Unix operating system and actually started her own technology company. And when I got out of law school at Duke University in 1981, Ellen and I decided we'd come to Atlanta thinking that this would be a great place to settle initially before we might move back to Charlotte or to Washington, D.C. or someplace else. And my sister gave me a call after about 2 weeks of my law practice and said she was thinking about maybe starting her own company, which I found was interesting. And I said, well, Gene, you know, I'm a lawyer now, and you probably need to follow these 500 steps before you start your own company, and this is probably going to take you about a year and a half. So, you know, give me a call back in a year and a half after you follow these steps, and we'll help you start your company. Well, needless to say, about 2 days later, she called me up and said, guess what, John? I've started my new company. I'm out on my own now. So I didn't follow any of those 500 steps, but I'm an entrepreneur. And so she started the business, got me out there right away, and I began visiting people in Silicon Valley. So I had the good fortune early on to see what the Valley was about. But thanks to my wife, Ellen, and the good friends I had in the Atlanta community, I decided building in Atlanta, that ecosystem similar to Silicon Valley, was going to be much more inspirational and, frankly, much more exciting than just plugging myself in as another pawn in the Valley. Silicon Valley is great, no doubt about it. But I was going to be a cog in the machine. Whereas here, I'd have the opportunity, particularly in the early 80s, to work with good people like you and others who were really building this technology community from the ground up. And so that's how it started, and we're very fortunate today to have built a very strong ecosystem here in the community and at Morris Manning & Martin.
Well, John, go a little bit further into that, because I do know 1981, 82, 83, there really wasn't a technology community. MSA was, you know, off the ground, and maybe a few other companies, but you really did make a decision to become fundamentally a foundation, if you will. Maybe that wasn't your goal, but that what has certainly occurred because of your giving nature. I think of the early days of SSA and Beta and WIT and Southeastern Software and how you really laid the foundation for that. Just kind of go into that a little bit more in depth. I mean, it's to me, it's such an incredible story. For those that are the newcomers, we had the great David Cummings on last week, and he was watching Sesame Street when you were building the foundation for his great success.
Well, you're very kind, Ricky. It has been a team effort all along. But maybe to just run the clock back a little bit to the early 80s, when I did make the decision along with Ellen to stay in Atlanta and really build the practice here, it was an interesting opportunity because we looked around and tried to find technology companies, and there really weren't that many companies here. Georgia Tech obviously was a mainstay of the tech community. But what we began to do was to say, let's form an organization. And my sister Jean on the West Coast said, you got to start forming an organization and you got to start writing. So at that time, I started writing for a publication called Computer Retailing that of all the cities in the country was headquartered in Atlanta. And at that time, computer retailing, believe it or not, was the center of the technology world. There were very few places to buy a microcomputer, and Computer Retailing was a magazine that largely was chock full of independent microcomputer dealers throughout the country who would advertise in this publication. So I remember Gene and I wrote an initial article about the Trash 80, TRS-80, which was a Radio Shack early stage PC. And that was the beginning of my writing career. So I began writing, began doing some speaking as a result, because there were very few people in the computer law market. And I'll never forget my first trip to Comdex, which at the time was one of the world's largest trade shows. It had just started, though. It was a computer technology show, and it was in Atlantic City. And I followed my sister Jean around during that show, visiting one booth after another, seeing one microcomputer company after another. And at that time, there were literally hundreds of computer companies, much like the early days of the automotive business, where everybody had an automobile or automobile manufacturing plant. And we visited those companies, and I said, this is for real. I do recall, though, there were a couple companies there that were from Atlanta. One was a company called Quadram that Leland Strange, who still is an active player in our community today, had. And I think the table was about the size of a coffee table, and they put a nice tablecloth on it, and he sold the six-pack quad board, which is a memory expansion board, and they were selling like hotcakes. And I concluded that the place to be was Atlanta, and the way to do it was to work with companies that were growing to help build that ecosystem.
Well, Comdex ended up moving to Atlanta and headquartering here for many, many years. I was not in technology. I was purely in the hospitality industry, but it was one of the largest shows in Atlanta for many years, and each organization tried to outdo each other in grandiose. And I remember a company a long time ago, Ashton Tate, who would hire the biggest name entertainers to do something at the Fox for their customers, and MSA and Mr. MLA were doing a lot of exciting things during that time. I had forgotten about Comdex. That's a great memory.
Well, it's interesting, too. You mentioned Ashton Tate. For those listeners who recall the early days of the 80s in the software area, and obviously Atlanta was really and has remained a software capital, I had a good friend that was a general counsel at Ashton Tate. They were located in Los Angeles, not in the Valley. I remember visiting with him one time, and I walked in and to the office at Ashton Tate, and they were a database manufacturing software company. And was talking to my friend, and I said, well, you know, can I meet Mr. Ashton and Mr. Tate? And they said, well, you can meet Mr. Tate because he's down the hall, but Mr. Ashton, well, Ashton's the name of the parrot out front. So it was a way for them actually to screen people who were trying to get into the company. But it's a very, very interesting history of the technology community. But it also highlights, I think, the fact that the basis for Atlanta's growth, and frankly, I think our future, is really software. When you look, you mentioned MSA earlier, but the software community has been the foundation. Now, software has morphed over time, And obviously we have new areas and avenues today. But if we look and see what the strength of Atlanta is and the really the greater metro Atlanta area, it's been software, starting in the early days and running through today.
I would like to spend the next 2.5 hours talking about the 80s, because this is great stuff. And you're going to come back here if I have to hire some big burly guy to drag you out of your office. But let's move into the 90s and the IPO frenzy. You were at the heart of that from day one. Let's talk about that for a little bit and your impressions and how it all came about, and then work us up to the bubble bursting.
Well, we at Morris Manning & Martin and the technology community in Atlanta was very fortunate in the 90s. It turned out to be a situation that a lot of the IPOs during the 90s were coming out of the software arena. And again, Atlanta has been a haven for software companies. What occurred was the venture capitalists also began to grow in the 90s. And at its height, Atlanta probably had 20 what I would characterize as viable venture capital funds. That is, they had money, they were out writing checks, they were writing Series A checks and Series B checks, and they were actively involved in the industry and in the market. Now, we all know that when we have a lot of venture funds that are actively going after companies, what's going to happen is they're going to drive valuations up. So we saw these companies grow very rapidly. We had indigenous venture funds. They were attracting other venture funds from outside the region. And we had a growth and a real growth spurt of technology companies, particularly in the software arena. Well, interestingly, those companies, many of them were able to hit a particular peak right around the late 90s when the IPO market was going crazy. And we were very fortunate at Morris Manning to actually handle more IPOs than just about any firm in the country. I still look at our conference room table and recall the number of investment bankers we had running through there to hold meetings of companies who were going public. And we were taking companies public like crazy. I think at one time we had 5 different companies who were in our conference room at one point or another, you know, going after preparing their prospectuses and filing their S-1s. That was a great time for the community and one of the most important times for technology software companies here. Because what an IPO does more than anything else is it provides fuel for the tank. So what occurs is, you can imagine, analogy to a bus, you drive the bus up and it just swallows up gas, but you know you can drive forever. Well, these technology companies were raising $50, $75, $100 million of cash that allowed them to go off and make other acquisitions. So the key for us at that time was the hope that these companies would get funded by the venture funds, again, because we had a lot of them, and then secondarily, once they went public, take this huge stash of cash that they had and make acquisitions. Roll the clock forward 10 years, what really occurred was, unfortunately, many of those companies were not able to get to the next level. There are still some, Manhattan Associates being probably the best instance of one that made it past the hump. But it was a tough time after that. But certainly it was the go-go days of the 90s, and we've never seen anything like it. I'm not sure in our lifetime we're going to see anything like it again.
That's not necessarily a bad thing, is it?
It's not. I think what happens is, you know, we see these, the phenomenon has been described by some investors as greed and fear. And I think that was a greed period of time, and there was a lot of greed going on, people trying to take their companies public. I do recall, actually, in one instance, I was at a client's meeting. I got a call to come out of the meeting. I was a client of mine who was about $10 million in revenues, and they were growing, but I wouldn't say that they were on a meteoric climb. And the client said, "You've got to get back to Atlanta right away. I know you're in a board meeting. You've got to come back. We're going to have an all-hands IPO meeting tomorrow morning, and we're going to go off and raise $150 million. And I thought, okay, you're a $10 million a year software company. You have, you know, barely reached that number, and you've got investment bankers that want to take you public and raise $150 million. Wow. So I got on the next plane, came back, and you know, we went out and actually had a successful offering. But I think that was clearly a time when there was a lot of overindulgence. Right after that, we went into the fear mode. And unfortunately, the venture funds, for which we had 20 or so previously, evaporated down to about 2 or 3, which was a big problem. The angels oftentimes in that environment were getting crushed. So the angel community dried up, and the investment banking community went through a metamorphosis and basically reduced in size. So we went from the go-go, so-called greedy times to the really sparse, you know, fearful times. Now I think it's much more of a happy medium at this point, but we will see those ebbs and flows, no doubt.
I guess from our common faith background, the teaching of humility was a good thing to have happened during that time period. I recall sitting in booth 61 at the OK Cafe talking to a young entrepreneur who looked at me in the eyes, and at that time, as you know, I was introducing a lot of people to a lot of the venture and angel community. He looked at me in the eyes and said, "Ricky, let me make sure you understand this. Do not introduce me to anyone who's going to mess with my valuation because I know what my company's worth." I looked him in the eyes and said, "I'm going to do you one better than that. I'm not going to introduce you to one damn soul. You are too cocky to be doing business with me or my friends." I'm sure you saw a lot of that as well.
Well, I did. And I tell you, one thing that's been so good about this community, and you and I both know this to be the case, Atlanta is a wonderful city. It's a great place for people to grow and build a company. And I'll tell you, one of the things that really makes me proud of our city, people like you, David Cummings, so many people that are out there that are willing to give of their time to entrepreneurs to help them build, make contacts, and grow relationships. I think the other element of it is, and you're right, there were a lot of folks that were, you know, frankly, very successful and unfortunately sometimes got a little too self-centered. But what we have seen, and this is what we need to see more of, is serial entrepreneurs. That is, people that have been out there, done it once, done it again. And I think the one hurdle we have to get over here in our community is that every time you do it, you're not going to be successful. The Valley is full of people that have been successful and unsuccessful. And it's just a typical arrangement out there. And I think outside of the Valley, sometimes there's a stigma that if you didn't have a successful startup, there's something wrong with you. Well, most of the people in the Valley that have had successful startups or had successful companies now, they've had a lot of failures. It's a lot like politics, Ricky. I think, you know, politicians oftentimes, they lose the first couple races, but they come back up and oftentimes will find themselves in a position where they are in leadership positions down the road. So we're building that serial entrepreneurial base, but we need to be forgiving of those entrepreneurs who may not make it the first time or even the second time.
The angel, and we're going to move off the investment community in a minute, but angels and venture capitalists in Atlanta, where is it today and what do we need to do to improve it? Because I constantly hear we just don't have enough angels. Then Sig is semi-retired and then came back into the game, but how can we attract more angels? I think David Cummings' success is going to help, and David plowing money back into the community. But what are some of the other characteristics you think we need to have a more vibrant community in addition to success?
Well, I think we have to look at this so-called financing food chain to really see what is the situation with regard to financing. And in that regard, when we look at it for an early-stage entrepreneurial company, what you have to do is to say you've got the angels, you've got the Series A venture financings, you got the Series B venture capitalists, and then you have the private equity funds. And so you look at those groups and you say, where are we today? The good news is we're not in the 2002-2003 time frame where the venture funds had evaporated. You couldn't find the investment bankers and they'd splintered and nobody else was around to write a check. Today, it's actually a very interesting food chain. And what we see is, thanks to the Atlanta Technology Angels and the good work that Bernie Dixon and others are doing there, ATA has become a very viable group for angel investing. Morris Manning is proud to be a sponsor there, and there's a number of others that have been helping to get that group vibrant again, and it really has been successful. And so we're seeing good activity in the angel world, and thanks to the ATA, it's probably one of the best organized angel organizations in the country. We also have Series A financings here in town, but unfortunately, we don't have enough. We've got great funds like Nora Mosley, who's here, but after that, it really tails off. We've got a few others that have been involved, some good folks over at Buckhead Investments, some good folks that come in from some other sections of the country, but there's a dearth of Series A financing. So the biggest challenge we have now is companies that might get angel funding through the ATA or other sources, but then they've got to get that next round of capital. After the Series A financing, we're finding more and more growth venture funds. Growth funds that basically want to invest in a company that's got $10 million in revenues, has referenceable customers, has a scalability path, but needs additional capital to get there. And those funds are oftentimes coming in from outside the state and are very, very interested in our growing companies here. So if we have to see where's the missing link in that food chain, it's probably that Series A investment. It's that company that's looking for the $1 to $5 million in capital to really get themselves to a point of profitability. And right now, that's probably our biggest challenge. And it's an area where we at Morris Manning are particularly spending a lot of time with our clients, introducing them to funds and to super angels who will help to fill that void.
You've been involved in lobbying at the state level on the ability for our state pension funds to be able to be invested into earlier stage companies. We're 4 days of the legislature left at this moment. Where are we in the process?
Well, I have to say that I think Georgia, unfortunately, has been a little bit behind in this area. And the good news is that there have been efforts, and it looks like we will hopefully have success in extending the angel tax credit, which is a very valuable thing, basically providing certain tax credits to angel investors. Also, the idea of creating a venture fund in Georgia, or a fund that will invest in other venture funds. So you never know with the legislature. You know the political game a lot better than I do, Ricky. I gave up on it years ago. But I'm very hopeful that our legislators will realize that it's important for us to be able to funnel some dollars back into the community. I don't believe that at the end of the day, government's the best source of venture capital, but I do think it's important for us to show the rest of the country that our legislature has made decisions that will allow some of those funds to be funneled back into entrepreneurial ventures here in Georgia. So I'm optimistic. I think we all need to continue to notify our legislators and work with the groups around town, including TAG and the good work they're doing there to promote legislation that will be supportive in this area.
Sadly, we're one of the few states that does not allow that today, which really puts us behind the eight ball in many situations. As someone that's been around since the beginning of the organizations and then in the late 90s when we saw the merger of WIT, Women in Technology, Southeastern Software, and Beta to the creation of TAG, Technology Association of Georgia, where are the technology organizations today in the community, and how do you see TAG is now the umbrella and the end-all, be-all for all practical purposes?
That's a good question, and maybe I'll run the clock back just a second here too, Ricky, to say that you mentioned earlier about how I got involved in the industry, and I had recollected on how we had started an organization. We decided early on, and the predecessor to TAG was a group called Beta, B ampersand TA, but we didn't really have a software group. And so my sister in 1983 suggested that we form a software association of sorts. And so I went into the office of one of my colleagues. At the time, our firm was very small. And I said, let's create a software association that would be for software entrepreneurs. And he looked at me and said, I think that's a great idea. And he said, what do we call it? The Atlanta Software Society. And I said, Atlanta Software Society. I'm not sure that acronym is going to work. So why don't we be a little more regional here? Why don't we call it the Southeastern Software Association? So we flipped it. So the Southeastern Software Association was born. And actually, my sister Jean Yates was our first speaker. We had her come in from Silicon Valley. The first meeting, believe it or not, was at the Georgia Pacific Auditorium downtown. I doubt if they've ever had a technology event since then. And it was the one place we could go that could fill up a room of about 200 or 300 people. There was there were no other large facilities at the time. And we started the Southeastern Software Association. Today, of course, SSA is a part of TAG, WIT as well. And TAG has just done a great job, quite frankly, of building the organization within our community that is really bringing the technology entrepreneur, technology companies, and traditional businesses together. And under the great leadership of Tino Mantella and a very strong board, I've been very proud to be involved and one of the co-founders there and continue to be supportive of what TAG's doing. It's probably one of the most successful technology organizations in the country.
I cannot overemphasize the importance of what happened in the 80s and even to today, but Morris Manning and Martin actually being the focal point for meetings. I can recall a networking group you put together, oh gosh, in the late 90s, and we were sitting around a conference table in your office on September 11th, 2001, when the buildings came down, and we received the phone call. Bill Leonard's wife called us into your office. So, we all owe you a great debt of gratitude. I won't go on that tangent very, very long, but it required someone standing up and saying, okay, I'll do it, and the rest has been history. Legal issues, what are some of the more pressing legal issues for your technology clients today as opposed to what they were 15 years ago or 20 years ago when the go-go days were here?
Well, in the go-go days, the really fundamental ones that we'd almost laugh at today, you know, is software protectable? Is object code protectable under the copyright laws? Can you get a patent on some on software as a part of an invention? Those were questions that were not answered in the 80s and had to be answered through court cases. And fortunately, they were answered over time in a way that hopefully was very advantageous to technology and technologists to provide for protection. What's occurred since that time probably are two very significant changes. One has been what I'll characterize as a regulatory overlay, and that is there were very few regulations in the 80s. I mean, it was a wild, wild west, and even into the 90s. With the collapse of the financial markets and the dot-com markets, we saw government regulation come in to the equation. So now, with just about any area of software or technology, you're going to find a very deep penetration of regulatory issues. I'll give you an example, healthcare. You've got HIPAA issues. You've got regulations coming out almost weekly. And those impact our healthcare IT companies, which is a very key portion of our technology community here. Privacy and security, huge issues now, ones that were ignored for years. As a matter of fact, states had their own laws in this area. There was lore, L-O-R-E, as opposed to law, L-A-W. Now what we're seeing is this confluence of lots of different laws in the area, federal regulations, different departments issuing regulations. Sometimes they're inconsistent. State laws. What we're lacking at this point, though, is uniformity. And so our next great challenge is to come up with uniformity in this area, similar to the Uniform Commercial Code that was developed, you know, back in the 50s and 60s. We need that uniformity, not just nationally but globally, in order to help growth. Because otherwise, despite my love for the legal profession and attorneys, we don't need to be spending useless resources in that regulatory area. We really need uniformity so we have certainty. So I think we're going to see continued growth, but unfortunately, these privacy security issues are compounded by the mobile world. And so you add mobility to it, you get security, privacy, mobility, and that's really a formula for complexity. And we need to make it as simple as we can, but it's going to take time to reconcile these various jurisdictions and these various laws. So for the time being, you know, our firm, for example, is a very active privacy security area. We've got a very active healthcare group. We've got, you know, very active folks that are focused on large technology transactions, on sourcing. And each one of those groups has to stay abreast of recent legal developments, particularly in the regulatory area.
I guess because of the go-go days in the late 90s, early 2000s, it seemed like every issue I heard was something around pricing. Everybody was in trouble on how they priced their options in the IPO world. I guess that's not something you have to lay awake at night worried about today.
Well, pricing still is actually an issue, but you're right. It's not as serious as it used to be. For the benefit of those folks that might not remember the 90s and the IPO craze, the big problem there that came into play and that the SEC continued to focus on were companies that would issue options at a very low valuation, rock bottom numbers, and then come out 2 months later with an IPO that was, you know, at some wild magnitude of higher valuation. And the SEC would come in and basically, in that situation, apply a doctrine called cheap stock and would therefore require an expense to be applied to that early stage company. That's largely gone away in no part because of the fact that the IPO market has disappeared to a large extent. But we still see issues of valuation, and the reason valuations become important is not so much for the IPO, but it's ultimately on the exit. So more and more we're working with our clients to say, every move that you make, every decision you make, think about how it impacts the exit. How does it impact your ultimate sale or public offering, but more likely a sale? And how do you maximize valuation? So we're constantly saying, don't just make a decision in a vacuum, whether it's a business decision, a technology decision, or a legal decision. Think about how it's going to impact you in achieving and fetching the highest valuation when you ultimately have that liquidity event. It's a little different from what we did in the old days where it was just pedal as fast as you can and don't worry about it.
Let's back up a second to something you just mentioned on security being such a huge issue today. I was fortunate to hear Joel Brimmer, I believe is his name, a former top official in the government and also an attorney at Cooley Goddard in D.C., speak to GCLA, and he basically told a room full of 50, 60 CIOs, You cannot protect your privacy. You cannot protect your data. Decide what to protect and fight like the dickens for that, but there are complete office buildings in China and other parts of the world that know more about you than you know about you. From a legal standpoint, where does that put us? How do we protect the privacy of our clients and the general public as a whole?
In the privacy area, I think there are really a couple areas that you have to focus on. One is legally making sure that your contracts and your agreements with your customers, strategic partners, address those areas. And that's why we've got good lawyers, and that's why Morris, Manning & Martin is out there focusing on those issues every day. From a technical standpoint, it's making sure that your technology is up to date in this area and that you've got good vendors. And Atlanta's fortunate to be a real key leader in the security area. But I think, Ricky, maybe the main area of concern here is practical, which is practically, can you stop what's going on in China? The answer is no. I heard the other day a speaker was talking about the Ukraine, and the point was made that U.S. companies were not allowed to go in and monitor certain activities in the Ukraine because the Ukraine closed that down so that they could basically keep their underworld of software pirates in business. Well, when you have countries like that, you know, it's extremely difficult to say practically that you're going to be able to solve the problem. So I think it's a confluence of those three areas. You have to look at practical, you have to look at the technical, and look at the legal, and just be aware that what you put out there is likely to appear. I think it's probably highlighted by this last incidence of the First Lady having her personal information being disclosed, and I guess Beyonce and some other folks that were in the same situation. So it's be careful what you put on the web. And I guess the way I always look at it is whatever I put on the web and whatever I'm searching on the web, if somebody were to flash it on the front page of the Wall Street Journal someday, I wouldn't be embarrassed by it.
I am so glad that we did not have the technology today in the early 70s when I was a Ute, because I would have been looking for my first job at this point that was not involved with a filling station. but thank God that is all over with. One more legal issue that I think a lot of people face, it's not purely technical, but the sales tax issue, where do you see that going? The state of Georgia has ruled that we have to begin collecting, and yet we're not.
Ultimately, the sales tax issue is a very complicated one. It deals with both constitutional issues and issues of situs or location. I think what will likely happen over a period of time is that more and more states are going to need to fetch that revenue, and so as they do that, they're going to look and impose a sales tax, and they're not going to give the advantage to the online retailers. It's probably just a matter of time before that, you know, catches on in almost all jurisdictions, and you really I struggle to see that that the online retailers are going to have an advantage there. So at the end of the day, I think they're going to probably lose that advantage. Sales taxes are going to be collected, and people need to be prepared for it. In the current environment, if you're in that situation and you're going online, you probably need to be very careful to make sure that you are aware of it. And if you're not collecting sales tax, you need to be in a position to where you're prepared if you do get audited or if there are questions later raised, how you're going to deal with it. And it's challenging because finding the customers to go and collect the sales tax from is going to be a challenge.
You have one son, Paul, and he is your favorite child. I have three children. They are all my favorite child, depending upon which tie is the nicest at Christmas. You've dealt with literally hundreds, if not thousands, of companies in the last 30 years. Tell us a couple of favorites without offending some of those that maybe were a little more trouble than they were worth. But from the 80s all the way to today, you know, just a thumbnail on two or three companies that just stand out as it was just a joy to have the opportunity of working with them.
I had the good fortune early on, Ricky, of working with several companies. And at the time in the early 80s, there weren't a lot of technology companies around. I worked initially with a company that was called ExtraSoft. And ExtraSoft was a company that actually was located in the Southeast but ended up moving to Silicon Valley. But they allowed me to be in a position to really understand what the software community was about. They were a point-of-sale vendor. And it was a delight to work with them. And I recall Sharon Thornton, who was the CEO, had polio when she was young, and she didn't let that stop her for 1 minute. And it highlighted the fact that when it came to the entrepreneurial community, if you have the entrepreneurial DNA, it doesn't matter. You're going to be driving forward, And she also was a very kind and considerate person. So she highlighted the fact that there could be, you could have a value system and a set of principles and still be a driver. Rolling it forward about 10 years, I had an opportunity to work with a good friend of mine, Bill Nussey, who today is the CEO of Silverpop. I was introduced to Bill. He had a company that was actually in North Carolina called Da Vinci Systems, which was a leading email vendor, one of the leading email vendors in the world at the time. And I learned a lot from Bill. Bill has been a great friend. He sold his company successfully, went to Harvard Business School, became a leading venture capitalist, came to town as the CEO of a company, and today as the CEO of Silverpop. And I have learned so much from Bill. And frankly, his ability to grow companies and build a culture and really care about other people and also raise a wonderful family. And then I recall a company called, believe it or not, MicroStuff. And MicroStuff was a company that was a go-go company, and it actually represented a chapter in the Atlanta technology community that's little known, but it might have been the highest flying chapter we've ever had so far. I recall coming back to my office one day, and there was a message. This was in the days where you didn't have email. You just had these little pink slips, and it said, call Les Fried, Microsoft. They want to hire you. Well, I saw this, and I thought, Microsoft wants to hire me. I said, ka-ching, ka-ching. This is the payday. Well, I called Les, and it turned out he wasn't Microsoft. He was MicroStuff. But interestingly, MicroStuff was a very interesting company. They had a product called Crosstalk, and this was in the day when you had to buy a modem, and then you had to buy the software to run the modem, and that's how you got how you communicated with folks. And MicroStuff's Crosstalk product was built for 16-bit computer, and they needed a lawyer, and they were doing deals all over the world, and he became one of my favorite clients. Got involved with him, started doing work, was, I think, 3 or 4 years before we sold the company. And Les Fried has remained a dear friend. Matter of fact, he moved to Florida to retire and introduced me to a new client recently. So it's, again, the idea of these serial entrepreneurs, people that have done it before, doing it again. Bill's in that category. Sharon was in that category. That's the joy of really working here, particularly in the Atlanta community, where we've built this ecosystem and it continues to now evolve and grow.
What's it going to take to make Atlanta and Georgia Technology Roadmap? And I know you've been involved in TAG creating the roadmap and coming up with the blueprint of where we were and how we got here. But what is it going to take over the next 3 to 5 years to take it to the next level?
You know, the next level for Atlanta and Georgia and the technology areas, it's hard to predict, but I think if there's a couple points that we can highlight here. One is it's going to be important for us ultimately to focus. And software's been the focus of what we've had for so many years, starting with MSA and going through many, many companies that have been successful. But if you look at certain areas of the country, San Diego when it comes to biotech, medical devices in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, obviously the Valley, Route 128. If we can begin to focus in particular areas where we have particular strengths and double down, it's going to be to our advantage. And I give you some examples. So there are three areas that are key for us right now, healthcare IT being one. We have some very fine healthcare IT companies, but it's going to be a challenge for us to make sure we take those companies and help them grow. Another one would undoubtedly be, in our situation, financial technology companies. We are a hotbed of payment processors. Can we build more companies in that area? We've got a number of groups that are focused in there. It's important for us to find the venture fuel to keep those companies going. And then I think the third, and maybe the most exciting, but also the most challenging, is mobile. You know, we have a very active mobile community. The Metro Atlanta Chamber, through the good work of Larry Williams and Sam Williams, have really grown the technology focus of the chamber, and they're very focused on mobility. The question would be, how do we help early-stage entrepreneurial companies get the funding to be able to be players there? We're fortunate to have the AT&Ts of the world here. But getting those areas that we're focused on and then finding the capital are going to be the two keys. And finding the capital means getting the capital to Georgia, not necessarily meaning that they're going to headquarter here, but bringing them to town. It's an interesting aside that one of the things that we're doing as part of the value add for our clients is we invite in venture funds. We invite in private equity funds. We invite super angels in. And we use this as an opportunity to say, come to Atlanta. Let us introduce you to some exciting companies. I had a call today with a mezzanine debt equity fund out of Philadelphia He said, I don't know a lot about Atlanta, but I want to find opportunities to invest there. So I said, well, listen, come on down. It's a lot warmer here than it is in Philly. So that's going to be important for us, and we think that there's an opportunity there to grow significantly in our community through that.
There are people that have known you over the years. You've got the reputation as the king of the technology community, but the emerging growth and companies pre-IPO and into their development process, yet you've worked with some of the biggest companies of them all, UPS and others. Timing-wise, where you find yourself now at this part of your career, more in the big companies, or are you still taking the time to spend some time with the upstarts?
It's a great question. In the technology area, we constantly have to be resegmenting the market because it does change so dramatically. What we've done now is we really look at three key areas. In the startup area, which let's say is be from 0 to $5 million in revenues, we've basically focused and said we want to see every startup that's out there. We want to see if we can help them. We want to see how we can be of assistance to them. The ones we really want to represent, we describe as premium startups. And a premium startup doesn't necessarily mean any one thing, other than the fact that we've analyzed it and believe that they have a strong likelihood of being a significant company someday. They may have a major customer. They may have a significant management team. They may have an entrepreneur who strikes us as being super smart. They may be in an area that we think is red hot. But we'll assess that, and with our team, we'll sit down and look at the IP. So I can bring in my IP guys to look at it. We can bring in my technology transaction team to look at it. We can have our folks from the securities venture side look at it, and we can make an assessment of that entrepreneur. But we really want to look at those premium startups, see them all, but really focus on the premiums. In the middle market, from $5 million to $100 million, it's interesting. That market is growing, I think, more rapidly than any part of our community currently. And it's growing in part because those companies that earlier in this decade could not get capital are now saying to themselves, why did I need venture capital? I can do it on my own. I skipped the Series A round. I skipped the Series B round. Now I'm looking to grow my business. I probably go right to private equity. So those companies are very interesting to us, and we've developed some excellent relationship with the private equity funds who generally write checks anywhere from $5 million to $100 million to help those companies grow. And then the third category, which we call actually our Project 500 category, and that's Fortune 500, or if you want to expand it, Fortune 1000. Those are companies that generally are looking for specific expertise. They need somebody that has knowledge in the privacy area, in the security area, that understands open source software, that knows about technology transactions and can handle big deals. So we focus on those areas as well. So we've got those three markets, and we think we've got a solution set that addresses those in a way that helps those companies grow.
You know, without trying to put you on the spot too much, I know of your involvement in the community from many aspects, but in addition, you and Ellen have been tremendous benefactors to the community, especially in childhood cancer. I know the YMCA in DeKalb honored you a couple of years ago, and even having watched you serve on the United Way Technology Task Force at the greatest growth they ever achieved. And now there's a John C. Yates Award given away every year to a technologist. Talk a little bit about that, and then I want to end with you telling us how you've the transformation from pure technology into the pure community leader, being very active on the chamber board, but more so, you have been chosen to be, and you are currently the chairman of the Final Four for the great games, March Madness, that are going to be here in a couple of weeks in Atlanta. Transition that, and then I'm going to do my best to find a date for the next show because we have not scratched the surface of John C. Yates.
Ricky, you're very kind. You know, it's interesting. I think one of the key things about this community and one of the remarkable aspects of this community are people like you and people in our tech community who care not just about their own company and their employees and their shareholders, but also about the community as a whole. And I've been very blessed to have a wonderful wife in Ellen who has always given back in so many different ways. I think she learned it in large part as a result of her wonderful parents, her mother who's always given back, and her dad who was a pastor and was obviously always serving others. So Ellen and I felt it's important as part of our community to really help to serve others and to give back the much of the largesse that's been conferred upon us, fortunately, as a result of the activities we've engaged in. You mentioned Cure Childhood Cancer, and our son had cancer when he was young. And as a result of that organization, our son is doing great today. God has blessed us, and he is just a wonderful young man. And Cure is a great organization providing research dollars as well as supporting families who are going through the real trauma of having a child that has cancer. Ellen's also been very involved in the YMCA and giving back there. I realize that she could join any fitness center, club, or organization she wants to on the planet, but she thinks the YMCA is the place to serve, and she has done a great job of that. People describe Ellen and me as somewhat the interchangeable Yateses because we tend to be involved in things together, and when one of us can't serve, the other one will fill in. We've been very involved in organizations in the community, young audiences through Woodruff, which has been a way to give back, particularly for kids who are trying to promote their own interest in the arts and culture and music. And then beyond that, actively involved in our church, as well as through the Downtown Rotary Club and Metro Atlanta Chamber. I do have to say, though, Ricky, you have been a key player in this whole process, and you may or may not recall, but years ago, you strong-armed me in a very professional way, as only you know how to do, as having one of the biggest arms of anybody I know, and convinced me to lead the technology initiative for the Metro United Way. And that was really the beginning of the opportunity for me to see what could be done in this community and the number of great people we had. And thanks to you and working with Jim Kelly, then the CEO of UPS, I really understood what this community was all about. That led several years later to the Atlanta Convention and Visitors Bureau and the Metro Atlanta Chamber asking me to chair the 2013 Local Organizing Committee for the 2013 Final Four, which is the 75th anniversary for the Final Four, which will take place in literally a week and a half. So April 6th through 8th, we'll be involved in what will be the biggest sporting event on the planet. And as the 75th anniversary, we think it's going to be the most outstanding sporting event that we've ever seen in Atlanta. Literally 5 days of activity going on here where we will be at the center of the universe of basketball. And we're very excited about that and hope that people will come down to Centennial Park and the World Congress Center to see some of the great things that are going on there. So it's been my honor, Ellen's honor, to serve this community. We're very proud that our son, Paul, is also involved here and looking forward to him carrying on the tradition.
Final Four includes Duke?
We hope so. I tell you, it's a rough road, Ricky, for Duke to get to the Final Four. We have to beat Michigan State on Friday, and then we're going to have to play most likely Louisville on Sunday. So I got my fingers crossed because that would be an unbelievable Final Four. No matter who's there, it's going to be spectacular, and we're sure we're going to have four great teams, and not just three great games, not just the two semifinals and the finals, but also, interestingly, we will have the Division II and Division III championship games that will be played in Phillips Arena on Sunday afternoon, and they are going to be free to the public. So you have an opportunity. If you want to see some basketball, you don't have tickets, come down to the park, listen to some of the bands. We're going to have Sting, Dave Matthews Band, Zach Brown, Ludacris, I know your favorite, Flo Rida will be there. And then you can go walk right into to Phillips to watch those games for Division II and Division III. Then you walk over to Brackettown and the World Congress Center to see all the sports the NCAA has. And then you can go over to the Dome to see the game. So it's going to be spectacular, and we think it'll be the best event ever for Atlanta.
I'll have to get down there. Ludi and I are pretty tight. I had the opportunity of seeing him at the TED. My daughter took me to one of the outdoor concerts, and I did have the joy of seeing Ludacris Bridges and actually ate at his restaurant Straits a few times. So Ludi and I, we're together.
Outstanding.
Now, for anyone who wants tickets to the Final Four, you have them, I'm sure, in your office, and just call you and, you know, just ask Lita. Pull them out of the drawer?
Right. My number is actually forwarded to Ricky Steele. So it's, but I will tell you, though, the interesting thing about tickets, and this is something for your listeners to keep in mind, if you want tickets to the Final Four, just go online. Prime Sport, which actually here in town, is the authorized coordinator of tickets, and there is a ticket exchange, and you can literally go on and buy tickets. People that have tickets can also post their tickets to be sold. So there are tickets available. obviously for a price, but it's a great opportunity for purposes of being able to really find a way to get involved, and you can do it very easily by going to the Prime Sports site. So use that as an opportunity to, you know, partake of the events. And Bracket Town, which is the Fan Fest, is just $10, so it's easy to fork over $10 and spend time really seeing what will be over 80 sports that are going to be highlighted in Bracket Town at the World Congress Center. So don't let the absence of tickets keep you from coming down and participating.
Well, John, this has been a great blessing for me, and I know to anyone that listens, that this will be downloaded many, many times. When are we going to get the John Yates book?
Ricky, I've been writing a book actually for about a decade. It's I'm trying to follow in your footsteps and the good books you've written. This book is called The Art of Business Friendship, and I started about 10 years ago. I believe the title is now going to be changed to The Art of E-Business Friendship because it's become an e-business world. But we're still working on it. It's a work in progress, and it will be finished soon, and I hope it's as big a seller as your books have been.
John, this has been a blessing. This is Ricky Steele. We finished our coffee in Booth 61. Hope you'll come back and join me next Wednesday for a fresh cup. I always close sharing a blessing for you, for your family, and for your business. This blessing comes from the book of Numbers. May the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. May the Lord turn his face toward you and give you peace. Amen. I am Ricky Steele, and thank you for visiting Booth 61.